he was put on that plane from Texas to El Salvador.
Mi hijo es todo.
My son is everything to me. He is a young man who is very introverted, a person who loves to learn, who loves to help other people. He is a homebody and 100% supportive of his dad, his brother, and me, his mom. Andri last called me on March 14th at 6:30 in the afternoon, telling me he was coming home, that they were going to transfer him to another detention center in Texas, where the plane was going to bring them to Venezuela. The plane was carrying all of the other innocent young men. But the plane didn't come here. It was sent to El Salvador. I found out my son was there the following Thursday. From then on, our lives changed. We were so happy waiting for him to come home so that all of his trauma would end. Instead, everything got worse.
Andri and I were in touch when he was in detention in the United States. He basically never entered the U.S. He was detained from the moment he showed up for his asylum appointment. That's when this process began. One day he called me and said, Reina, they're linking me to Tren de Aragua. I need you to get me photos, all the documentation from the three wise men because of the crowns. I sent these documents and evidence so that he could defend himself, something U.S. authorities never gave him the right to do. He never had due process. I've known Andri since we were kids. I'm older than him. I'm 36 and he's 32. We've been neighbors for over 20 years. We also have relatives in common. We spent so much time together. We drank coffee. We went out to dinner. We would hang out here at my house. He did my makeup. He was my confidant, and I was his confidant. We had a very close relationship, more than a friendship, like siblings. We also worked for the same Three Wise Men Foundation, where Andri has been an actor for 25 years. This is the festivity, the Capacho Three Kings Foundation, which has been in existence for 108 years. We are part of the artistic, cultural, and religious heritage of the municipality, this state, and Venezuela. It has a long history, and Andri has participated as an actor since he was 7 years old. He has participated as an actor, stylist, makeup artist, and costume designer. If we don't fight for him, who will? This is all so painful. We need Andri to know that he is not alone.
When my son left to the United States, he would tell me and his dad that he's going to help us and that he would make his dream come true to have his own salon. And they thwarted all of that. They stepped on him, ran him over, completely shut down his dream. Now, what is my boy going to do? My message to Andri is that I love him, that I want him to come home, that I want him to be strong. He is a warrior. His dad, his brother, and I are eagerly waiting for him. We are doing everything in our power to bring him home.
And the United States government claims to be law-abiding, democratic, and committed to justice and the law, but it isn't. There is no evidence that this is happening.
That was Reina Cárdenas, Andri's best friend, and Alexis Romero, his mother, speaking from their hometown of Capacho in Venezuela. Speaking to Democracy Now! Is Maria Inez Taracena and Nicole Salazar. Special thanks. We are in the studio with Andri's lawyer, Margaret Cargioli. How is this possible? The tattoos that supposedly the Trump administration has used. He was in a legal process in this Trump detention center seeking asylum. There is a tattoo on either hand of mom and dad, and they have a crown, as just described, because he lives in this town of king pageantry.
Yeah, so unfortunately, in many of these cases, because of having just benign tattoos, tattoos that many people have, such as a crown that says mom or dad, they accused him of being part of Trindaragua. They presented no other records, no criminal records, no arrest records, just photos that they assume are connected to Trindaragua.
So explain what the judge has said in this case, Judge Boasberg.
Yeah, so in the JGG versus Trump case, it's a federal court case. Recently, Judge Boasberg said that the men's rights were violated when they were sent to El Salvador and that the United States government needs to facilitate their due process rights. They need to present evidence as to how they're going to give them right, for example, to habeas. We believe that they need to be returned to the United States in order to be afforded those rights.
And his best friend, Reina, just tried to get to see him in El Salvador and couldn't, along with other relatives. She was denied.
Yes, unfortunately, their family, friends, attorneys have had no direct access to any of the men that were sent to CECOT. You know, it's extremely concerning and alarming because we are not getting any information as to what's happening to their in their daily lives, as to their conditions. We know that Matt Gaetz recently went.
Matt Gaetz, the former disgraced congressmember.
Correct. Went
now
to
a podcaster.
Yes. Went to CECOT, walked through while these men were pleading for their freedom, making universal hand signals, SOS signals, asking for help, saying they were kidnapped. And he just walks through with other representatives. And that is the only video footage that we've seen of some of these men, including one
and
of our clients.
Why did Andri seek asylum here? Going through the correct process.
Yes, Andri last entered the United States with a CBP-1 appointment. He sought asylum because he was persecuted due to his political opinion and because he's LGBTQ+. He had the right to seek asylum in the United States.
I mean, the endless pictures of him as a hairdresser with models and that he so proudly put online.
Yes, you know, in the reports that have come out about many of these men, you know, their parents have shown photos to evidence who they were, where they worked. These are real human beings who we know have no criminal records, no ties to Trindaragua, but they've been silenced, purposefully silenced by the United States government.
We're about to go to the former head of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal. She is standing by in Washington. But I want to ask you about one more of a number of your clients, and that is Miguel. Where is he?
Miguel Rojas Mendoza is one of our clients. He had a hearing yesterday where I represented him virtually at immigration court. For the second time at a hearing where I asked exactly where he was deported, the government has told me that they cannot provide it. They confirmed he was removed from the United States, but refused to say exactly where he is. I asked the immigration judge.
He doesn't have a criminal record.
Correct. He has no convictions. He was apparently accused of Trindaragua because he also has benign tattoos. And in many of these cases, the government is seeking to dismiss them, close their immigration cases.
But explain, you're having a hearing in court yesterday, and they would not say where they sent this man to?
It is almost incredible to believe that yesterday in a United States immigration court hearing, I had to ask for these details and it was not provided to me. I was told that I need to send an email, was provided an email address where I could try to obtain more information.
About where Miguel was
sent
to.
About where, what country he was sent to.
But they admit that they kidnapped him, that they took him and sent him out of the country.
They did finally in this court hearing admit that he was removed. You know, it is quite astonishing that in the United States, people are being disappeared in this manner, and we're continuing to see these egregious immigration policies taking place all throughout the country where people are literally being kidnapped and families cannot find where their loved ones are.
Margaret Cargillo, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll be in touch with you again, Directing Attorney of Policy and Advocacy at Immigrant Defenders Law Center, joining us here in New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. As we turn now to the continuing crackdown on immigrants by the Trump administration. Just this week, it's been reported the administration plans to dismiss potentially hundreds of thousands of open asylum cases. Those targeted are anyone who entered the U.S. unlawfully rather than at a port of entry before applying for asylum. This would essentially shut down all possibilities of claiming asylum along the southern border. President Trump's already made it effectively impossible to make an asylum claim at ports of entry on the border the day he took office. Critics say these restrictions on asylum are flagrantly illegal. Also this week, the Supreme Court cleared the way for the administration to send deportees to third countries rather than their own. This ruling stems from a case last month in which the government tried to send a plane of immigrants, mostly Latin American and Asian, to South Sudan. The flight was diverted to a military base in Djibouti. A lower court had said deportees should have a right to challenge their deportation to third countries. Other countries that have been approached by the administration to take U.S. deportees include Ukraine and Libya. And the administration may add more than 36 countries to the blanket travel ban already in effect for 12 nations if certain conditions are not met. 25 of the 36 countries are in Africa. For more on these developments and more, we're joined from the Capitol by Congressmember Pramila Jayapal of Washington State. She's the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Immigration Integrity, Security Enforcement, begun holding a series of shadow hearings on Trump's immigration actions, most recently on what she calls third country disappearances and the weaponization of the immigration court. Why don't you, Congressmember Jayapal, take it from there? The weaponization of the immigration court and what these third country disappearances are.
Yeah, thanks so much, Amy, for covering this, as you always do. Look, this is an attack by the Trump administration on every part of the legal immigration system as we know it. And so the third country removals is the attempt of the administration to deport people to third countries without any due process. And once they are on a flight, obviously they then claim that they can't get those people back. And so this had been upheld by lower courts that this was unconstitutional, illegal for the government to do, because due process, as you know, is one of those clauses in the Constitution that's very clear. It doesn't say for citizens, it says for everybody. And so the government was losing in a number of lower courts, but then the Supreme Court, it got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, as you said, just announced that it was actually okay for the government to do this. And we have been trying to shine a light on the Immigration Subcommittee. We're in the minority, obviously, so we can't do official hearings. But I've started doing a series of shadow hearings to shine a light on all of the ways that the government is attacking immigrants and the legal immigration system. The first one was on third country deportations. The whole series is called Kidnapped and Disappeared. The second one, which we did yesterday, was exactly on what the attorney for Andre was just talking about. The fact that now what the government is doing is they have been dismissing cases when somebody shows up to be in compliance with the immigration system. They have appointments for citizenship, they have appointments for asylum, court cases. In some cases, immigrants have been waiting for years to go through this process. They finally, imagine what it's like when you finally get your appointment. You show up to your appointment and the government dismisses the case. Now, typically when the government has dismissed a case, it's because they decide they're not gonna pursue it anymore. In this case, the government is dismissing the case so that then as the person walks out of immigration court, they can be arrested, detained, and deported, again with no due process. And so this is a remarkable attack on the idea that immigrants should show up for their court cases. And it's a real catch-22, because if you show up, you could get detained and deported, arrested, detained and deported. If you don't show up, then you are now in violation of your of the immigration regulations, and you're deemed as an absconder. The reason they are trying to dismiss these cases is because once a case is dismissed, they can then put an immigrant into what's called expedited removal. Expedited removal means that you don't get due process. Now, there is a small provision where you can still make a case that if you're going to be deported back to your home country where you're going to be tortured, that theoretically there should be a process where you can challenge it again, which is the most inefficient thing because that's why you were in court to start with. But we know that that very small ability to challenge in a case of expedited removal is non-existent. So all of this to say that the government is using every way, whether it's cracking down on free speech, as we've seen with Mahmoud Khalil and Rumeysa Ozturk, whether it's cracking down and using this wartime authority of the Alien Enemies Act. That was a law from 1798 that essentially says if there's an invasion, then the government can deport people. And what they're now saying is that these Andriy, other members, Arturo, a number of others, where the evidence is mainly these tattoos that are not related to gangs at all. These individuals can be deported. Venezuelans can be deported to El Salvador, to CICOT, and not have any due process. And
Very quickly, we're just
trying to shine a light on this.
Congressman Rajaipal, we have 30 seconds. The budget. Talk about the votes that's taken place and the decision of the parliamentarian in the Senate to strike down parts of it.
Yeah, well, there's a 60-vote threshold in the Senate for anything related to policy if you use a budget reconciliation bill. And so the parliamentarian has said that you can't, for example, tell states that they can't have a Medicaid provider tax. You can't say that states can't use their own money to provide Medicaid to immigrants of all legal statuses. You can't sell off millions of acres of public lands. These are some of the provisions that have been taken out of the Big Bad Betrayal Bill, which, just to remind people, kicks 16 million Americans off of health care and cuts SNAP benefits by $300 billion.
Congressmember Pramila Jayapal, I know you have a briefing you have to go to. I want to thank you for being with us as we go now. To a break, and then we remember Bill Moyers in his own words.
I want to go all over the world and start.
Someone by Lila Downs. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The legendary journalist Bill Moyers has died at the age of 91. In the 60s, he was a founding organizer of the Peace Corps, served as press secretary for President Lyndon Johnson. In 1971, began an award-winning career as a TV broadcaster that would last for over 40 years. During that time, Bill Moyers received over 30 Emmys, countless other prizes, many first programs on PBS, also a longtime champion of public television and independent media. His death coming at a time when the Trump administration is moving to strip federal funding from PBS and NPR. In 2011, Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed Bill Moyers. He outlined his critique of the corporate media.
Well, the consensual seduction of the mainstream media by and with the government is one of the most dangerous toxins at work in America today. They wouldn't see it this way, and there are exceptions, but the corruption of corporate media, corporate power, and government is what makes so vital what the two of you do. I'm serious about that. You don't have the scope of Meet the Press. I mean, look at Meet the Press. Who's been on Meet the Press more than any other figure in Washington in the last several years? Newt Gingrich, I later learned when I was briefly at NBC as an analyst doing commentaries, controversial commentaries, actually came to the brass of NBC and GE. Newt Gingrich has had some nefarious relationship with General Electric, which is one of the huge government contractors, as well as the owner of Meet the Press. And it's just an example of what I'm talking about, the consensual seduction of the mainstream media with power, corporate power, government power, with exceptions, I repeat, is something that without the antidote of independent reporting and analysis that you do and others, we would be in a dark, dark pit with no light shining on us.
I want to go back, since we're talking about broadcasting, right back to the Johnson era and then jump back to here, which is about the founding of public broadcasting and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, especially for young people, to understand why it began and where it's gone.
Well, there were three. Believe it or not, I mean, nobody below 40 will believe this. You may not believe it because both of you are much younger than I am. But when I was 20 years old, there were three networks: ABC, CBS, and NBC. And ABC was only half a network, no news division, all of that. And so we were dependent upon three corporate, advertising-driven, commercial networks for our information. And to his credit, Lyndon Johnson, who made his fortune, part of his fortune, by controlling the three. He had one station in Austin that had a monopoly over broadcasting the product, the content of all three networks. I mean, that's how he made his money, much of his money. But he really did believe. He was a teacher. He had taught poor Mexican students in the little town of Cotulla, Texas. He was a populist from a poor part of He came from Central Texas, went to South Texas to teach in this Mexican school. And he really cared about poor, and he cared about education. He felt there should be one channel that was free of commercials and free of commercial values, because he knew what commercial values will do to people who are reporting the news, producing content. The desire to amuse and entertain will cause us to compromise the truth. So when the Carnegie Corporation and the Carnegie Commission, John Gardner had been head of the Carnegie Corporation, and they did a study of what to do about educational television in this country. The report was actually delivered to my desk when I was still at the White House. The Carnegie Commission became the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. And I wish we had it here, because the speech Lyndon Johnson made when he signed the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 is a great tribute to a network devoted to the life of the mind, the life of the spirit, and the diversity of American voices. He believed that only white male straight guys got on national television in those days, and he was right. And he saw the value, the changes coming in America, and he believed there should be a public media that was devoted to the diversity, the pluralism of American life, and to the highest expression of the creative and journalistic arts.
And the actual act of the creating the Corporation for Public Television talked about serving underserved communities of America.
And unfortunately, as you probably noticed, that there was a report done by Fairness and Accuracy in Media, a public interest group. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting,
Fair.
And they show that even on public broadcasting today, in our mainstream broadcast, it's usually the official view of reality that's represented. Far more corporate spokesmen than labor or working people spokesmen. Far more white male figures of authority than people of color and marginalized people. That's just a tendency of human beings that always has to be resisted. And public television, public radio belongs to the people. Go back and read a great document, the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. And when we stray from it, as we sometimes do, the public has to rise up and say, we own you. We are your shareholders. Come back to first principles. Come back to first things.
So what has happened to public broadcasting right now? The onslaught. You talk about, you just wrote a piece about NPR and PBS, and you talk about, well, Nixon first tried to gut it and then take it forward.
Richard Nixon tried to succeed in fragmenting our authority, because he didn't like I was on the air. Robert McNeil was on the air. We were doing journalist work, but he called us liberals because we were trying to get at the facts. He and Pat Buchanan, his communications director, succeeded in harming, injuring public broadcasting back in the 1970s. Thanks to a great Republican who was chairman of the public television station in Dallas, we beat him off. They wanted to defund us completely, but they didn't. Then Newt Gingrich comes along. Robert Dole comes along with the right wing in the late 80s, and he tries to defund public broadcasting. Then comes Newt Gingrich in 1994, and then we had George W. Bush and his team who came after some of us on public broadcasting. Conservatives, on principle, don't believe that federal funds should be used to support the media. But then also they don't believe in allowing any alternative voices, any alternatives to the official view of reality to be heard. So they have always been against public broadcasting. And sometimes self-censorship occurs because you're looking over your shoulder and you think, well, if I do this story or that story, it'll hurt public broadcasting. Public broadcasting has suffered often for my sins, reporting stories the officials don't want reported. And today, only about a very small percentage of funding for NPR and PBS comes from the government, but that accounts for a concentration of pressure and self-censorship. And only when we get a trust fund, only when the public figures out how to support us independently of the federal treasury, will we flourish as an independent media.
Are you hopeful these days, despite the what we've discussed about the state of the media? We've obviously seen these enormous uprisings throughout the Arab world. On Democracy Now, we've covered the democratic popular renaissance that's occurred throughout all of Latin America in recent years, that there are parts of the world where things are hopeful. But right here at home in the United States, things don't always seem like they're heading in a good direction.
I think this country is in a very precarious state at the moment. I think, as I say, the escalating, accumulating power of organized wealth is snuffing out everything public, whether it's public broadcasting, public schools, public unions, public parks, public highways. Everything public has been under assault since the late 1970s, the early years of the Reagan administration, because there is a philosophy that's been extant in America for a long time that anything public is less desirable than the public than private. So I think we're at a very critical moment in the equilibrium. No society, no human being can survive without balance, without equilibrium. Nothing in excess, the ancient Greeks said. And Madison, one of the great framers of our Constitution, built equilibrium into our system. We don't have equilibrium now. The power of money trumps the power of democracy today, and I'm very worried about it. I said to her, and if we don't address this, if we don't get a handle on what we were talking about, money in politics, and find a way to thwart it, tame it, we're in trouble. Democracy should be a break on unbridled greed and power, because capital, like a fire, can turn from a servant, a good servant, into an evil master. And democracy is the break on my passions and my appetites and your greed and your wealth. And we have to get that equilibrium back. I said to a friend of mine on Wall Street, how do you feel about the market? He said, well, I'm optimistic. And I said, why do you then look so worried? And he said, because I'm not sure my optimism is justified. And I feel that way. So I fall back on the balance wheel in the Italian political scientist Gramsci, who said that he practices the pessimism of the mind and the optimism of the will. By that he meant he sees the world as it is, without rose-colored glasses, as I try to do as a journalist. I see what's there. That will make you pessimistic. But then you have to exercise your will optimistically, believing that each of us singly and all of us collectively can be an agent of change. And I have to get up every morning and imagine a more confident future and then try to do something that day to help bring it about.
The legendary Bill Moyers in 2011. He's died at the age of 91. Deepest condolences to his family. I'm Amy Good.
We're from the Kiwassa Preteen Spring Camp. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Campus Community Radio from Simon Fraser University on Burnaby Mountain.
Listen to Home of Burnaby Rock, CJSF's Lux Rock Electronic Show. 2 hours of relative power each and every Friday, 6 to 8 p.m., and repeats every Thursday, 10 to midnight, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Do it.